Blog Talk Radio.
Another exciting episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio. Today's show is called Taking a Bite Out of Crime, an interview with forensic dentist Michael Tabor. So now, without any further ado, we have your hosts of the show, Crime and Science Radio, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, thank you, John, and I want to welcome everybody to this edition of Crime and Science Radio, where we're going to interview my good buddy, Dr. Mike Tabor. Mike is an interesting character, to say the least, as you will see. He graduated from Carson Newman College and the University of Tennessee College of Dentistry and became a family dentist, which is what most dental graduates do. But then in 1983, he kind of took a turn and found himself immersed in the field of forensic dentistry, and this is a time when there weren't very many people plying that trade. Later in 2001, he was at the World Trade Center site helping identify countless remains there as a forensic dentist. He's also served as the president of the Tennessee State Board of Dental Examiners. He's written extensively on forensic dentistry, and he is currently the chief forensic dentist for the State of Tennessee Office of the Medical Examiner, big title. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Doug. Jan, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well,
great to have you.
You're a forensic odontologist, which is a big word for dentist. What attracted you to this field in the first place? What made you interested in that?
In addition to dentistry, I also have a passion for football, and for 25 years I've been a back judge for high school football in Middle Tennessee. One day in my officiating crew came our new state medical examiner. And at the halftime break, he said, you know, I've got an interesting body that just got pulled out of the Cumberland River here in downtown Nashville with numerous gold fillings in their teeth, and I have no clue where to begin. Would you like to help me? And 30-something years later, here we are on Crime and Science Radio. True story.
Well, I mean, you know, there's a big difference between, you know, doing fillings in the office and extractions and all of that and moving into forensic odontology. Did you have any special training at that time like they do now, or did you just kind of learn by the seat of your pants that this is what I needed to know and this is how I needed to approach this?
I actually... there weren't very many training programs at that particular time, and actually I had the good fortune of being mentored from two or three very close friends, Dr. Skip Sperber in San Diego, California, Dr. Richard Suveron in Miami, Florida, and Dr. Harry Mincer in Memphis, all three of which were giants in the field at that particular time. Dr. Richard Suveron, in particular, I had the pleasure of having him as my opposing expert witness in the first bite mark case that was ever admitted in a Tennessee court of law in 1985. That was just a few years after he had testified in the Ted Bundy case. And so here we have David versus Goliath in Nashville, Tennessee, and what was strange about that is afterwards we became the best of friends and have continued to enjoy a close personal and professional relationship as a result of the first bite mark case in Tennessee history in 85.
Well, you've obviously had a long and a storied career. We want to hear more of those stories. But I wanted to bring up that you had served as a past president of the American Board of Forensic Odontology and for the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, which is the huge umbrella forensic science professionals organization. You were a section chair, which is a big deal. And
thank you.
And you're also a fellow of their another honor. So it's clear that you're dedicated to high standards in your field. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what these organizations are doing in the world that's past this National Academies of Sciences study that ensure that forensic odontology maintains high scientific standards, and sort of what's in and what's out in the world of forensic odontology now that this study is out there saying that all of forensic science needs to be more scientific?
That's a great question, Jan. I think I'd have to start by saying that we certainly respect the National Academy of Science and certainly appreciate every bit of suggestions that they have for the field of forensics. You know, forensic odontology is really not a specialty of dentistry. It's a specialty of forensic science. And just like everything from jurisprudence to toxicology to question document examiners, we want to get it right. We want to get the best possible chance of helping to solve a mystery in our specific field. You know, we have about 12 disciplines within, recognized disciplines within the field of the American Academy of Forensic Science, which is kind of like the AMA for medical doctors or the ADA for dentists. And so when the NAS came out with some suggestions regarding their concerns about things that were happening in the field of forensic science, the American Board of Forensic Odontology, as well as the odontology section for the American Academy of Forensic Science, both sat up and took paid very close attention to these comments, ideas, and suggestions. We've really made several changes in the way that we are suggesting that our diplomates consider and how they consider their opinions for courtroom testimony. We're seeing now that roughly 10 cases or so in the last few years have had people who are on death row from being found guilty of a capital offense, and have since the popularity, or shall I say, the refinement of DNA analysis, have had the conviction overturned. In other words, the wrong opinion was given, and a person was falsely imprisoned as a result of that. Fortunately, we did get it right. And so we're really looking at this a little bit differently now. We do maintain that bite mark analysis is still, when used properly by a properly vetted expert, and that's the key word right there, a properly vetted expert witness. We're seeing that a lot of the times we're really being able to add value at crime scene analysis many times. But we're taking it a step further now because we want to make sure that we don't have 10 more of these over the next decade. And I think one thing that the Innocence Project, for example, is quite quick to point out these 10 fallacies, but what they fail to mention is there's been countless hundreds and scores of other cases where bite mark evidence was used properly and as a result was a very key tool at affecting the right verdict that the jurors came up with. One thing they forget sometimes is when they say, well, 10 people that were involved with bite marks were set free, there was a lot of other evidence in each of those 10 trials that we don't even know about, because we pride ourselves in knowing a whole lot about a very small thing. But there are lots of other witnesses. There are lots of other examples. There are lots of other factors that jurors have to consider when they come up with a verdict of guilt or innocence. It was not the forensic dentist that put him on death row. The jury has to, oftentimes, as they do with medical examiners, you'll have one side of a medical of a death case, and you'll have a medical examiner on one side opining that it was shaken baby syndrome. On the other side, you'll have another very well-respected medical examiner who opines that it wasn't shaken baby syndrome, but in fact it was SIDS, for example. Or then you want to get into other things that might would include, you know, was this homicide or was this suicide? And then you. My point is that we are trying our very best to get it right. We are recommending that every board-certified forensic odontologist seek a second opinion before he goes to trial. We're also recommending that we not make definitive statements if it's in an open population base as opposed to a closed population base. And we're really trying to make sure that we adhere to all of the recommendations and principles that NAS has suggested. It's a pretty long answer there, wasn't it?
But you know what? It's a great answer. I think, you know, I especially think, you know, you brought up a couple of points, which is that all of these cases are more complicated. While certainly sometimes, you know, we know that some piece of evidence may stand out more in a jury's mind than another, no trial goes in and presents one piece of evidence and says, okay, now decide on it. Any prosecutor has to, in a capital case, has to have more going than one item.
Right.
So to kind of further a little bit on that, what training is required to be a forensic odontologist? We know that you had to have years of training in dentistry, as you mentioned, but I think one of the really great points you made is that it's a specialty of forensic science. So what sort of training is required to enter the field?
To enter the field, interestingly enough, all that is required is knowledge in the profession of dentistry and an interest in forensic science. Majority of my training, and even to this day, up to this date, a lot of it has been OJT. I'm proud to announce on this show, however, for the very first time, that we are getting ready to change that because the field of forensic odontology is linking arms with the field of forensic anthropology. At what better place else to have it at the Body Farm at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville? Go Vols. Sorry, Doug. Anyway, starting in August, we will have the first postgraduate degree program in the United States where you can earn a master's degree in forensic human identification. We are actually merging the two fields, not merging them, but we're linking arms together because we do have a lot of overlap in the field. Forensic anthropologists, for example, will study more age, sex, and race, whereas odontology deals with comparing a known to an unknown. And that's how forensic dentistry really got started out. You know, there's 32 teeth in the human body. Each tooth has five sides with a name for each five of the five sides. And the possible combinations of what that allows is, the math professors tell me, is 5 to the 32nd power. That's a number that's bigger than the total number of the people that have ever lived on this earth combined. So to say that it's going to be around, and it's going to be around a long time. And so anyway, as these programs will grow and develop, hopefully forensic dentistry, there will be more more courses available for dentists to take in the field of forensic science. We now have one at the University of Texas in San Antonio and another one up in Detroit. A new one is starting in Las Vegas. But we're going to be at UT in Knoxville, going to be the first one to offer a master's degree program for those people that are interested in it. It's not just for dentists. It will be available to crime scene investigators, dental hygienists, anybody that has an undergrad degree and wants to further their education in human forensic identification. We're pretty excited about it.
That's worth being excited over. That's fantastic. And we're very honored to be the place where this is announced.
How about that?
You know, just for listeners, I think some people are not really sure what a forensic odontologist does. So can you kind of give us a brief overview of what the work itself is for a forensic odontologist?
I'd be happy to do that. First of all major cities have a board-certified forensic odontologist. But now we don't have but 105 or so in the United States, so there's not a whole lot of them to go around. But NAME, which you may be familiar with, the National Association of Medical Examiners, that's the credentialing service for all medical examiners' offices in the United States, recognize the importance of forensic odontology in their morgues. As a result, when each medical examiner's office has to recertify each periodically, one of the points that they check on is, are you affiliated with a board-certified forensic odontologist? And if they're not, they get dinged a few points. And you can't have but so many dings before you're not accredited. Well, that's like a medical school not being accredited by the American Medical Association. There's not much reason for them to exist. But basically, back to the question, Jan, and that is, what exactly do you do? And that is, we compare knowns to unknowns, which, you know, basically there's just three ways to identify a person in the first place, and that is DNA, fingerprints, and forensic dentistry records. So we have a body that's brought into the morgue, and we have to know before we can lend some credible information, who do you think that it might be? And if they have no idea, then we start from the other end of the fence and work backwards by making a detailed charting of each of the 32 teeth and each of those five sides to record whether or not there's a filling there, if so, what kind, and what surfaces of those five surfaces is included on each of the 32 teeth. If we still at that point, and we x-ray it, and we photograph it, and we make a complete record just like it's a live patient. And then if we still don't have any idea from the police or investigators who this might be, our next step is to enter it into our national, we have two national databases, NCIC and NAMIS. Each of those are computerized databases. One is accessible to the general public, the NAMIS one is. The other is accessible only to by law enforcement agencies. But in those instances, they will record any distinguishing characteristic on the body that is currently being held in this particular medical examiner's office. And so then we key punch it in, it goes into the national registrar and shoots out around the United States or the world. And therefore, if there was someone who had gold crowns on, and we go by numbers 1 through 32, let's say there was a gold crown on tooth number 2, 3, 4, and 5, that's a rather unique combination, and so you could put that in the database and see if there is a missing person that has been reported. And if so, then we're able to link that going from the back end towards the front. More often than not, what it is an automobile accident or a plane crash or a house fire where a family or an individual is burned and you're not able to tell the age, sex, or race because the body's burned too badly. But that's the one thing that forensic dentistry is so valuable in the fact that the teeth are virtually indestructible. They will withstand all environmental factors. You can put a body at the bottom of the ocean and pull it up 100 years from now, and the teeth will look exactly like they looked the day they went down. And you can't say that about fingerprints, and you can't say that most of the time about DNA, although I will say that as we are uncovering more aspects of DNA to include nuclear DNA, mitochondrial DNA, some types of DNA are more resistant than others. But anyway, in a car fire, the situation is no matter if it's a petroleum-based fire, the teeth are so resistant that very rarely will they be destroyed. So we clean them up and X-ray them, and then in the example I was using about the car crash where there was a fire, they will first run the VIN number for the car, and then they'll contact the owner of the vehicle and work from that angle, and then they will provide us with X-rays of who they think this might be. And then our goal then goes back to the same thing, be it DNA or fingerprints, and that is we're trying to match points of comparison on these 32 teeth, each with five different sides. We're trying to compare the known to the unknown and trying to bridge that gap and determine who the identification is.
Well, identifying remains obviously is critical in criminal investigations because, well, the killer usually knows the victim. And so if you can identify the victim, you're closer to getting the killer.
Exactly.
When the medical examiner, well, the police are called because they found some bones, and the medical examiner's called in, and he sees these bones scattered around in this rural area. And you mentioned earlier forensic anthropologist. Are both the anthropologist and the dentist called in about the same time? Is there an order to things? Does it matter? Do you work in tandem at the same time? Do they do their thing and then you do your thing? Or what's the logistics of how it typically goes in a death investigation?
Good question. In that scenario where scattered bones might be discovered in the woods, often the forensic anthropologist will be called upon first. They're such bloodhounds at evidence recovery. They just can find things that nobody else can find. And then they know exactly, they can pull up one bone, they can tell you, well, that's the right blah, blah, blah in that particular area. And so we wait and take the information that the anthropologists give us. They'll say, this looks to be a 6'2", African-American, male, and then we'll use that, or the missing persons division of the law enforcement agency will use that information to go back and look a little bit closer and to find out exactly what kinds of persons like that are missing that fit this description. Then we work very closely together. The book that I've written, we'll refer to it a little bit later, is the story of the most number one bizarre case I've ever worked in my career, and it took place at the body farm where I actually worked with Dr. Bill Bass, Dr. Murray Marks, and his contingency, where they actually were able to develop the age and sex characteristics, race characteristics, but it remained a John Doe for decades. And we sometimes, no matter how the chips just don't fall, you just have to wait, and you wait for additional findings. One of the most interesting things that they do at the body farm, and that's why we're excited to be taking this project off at the University of Tennessee with this postgraduate program, is they study what's called TSD, time since death. And they have studied by taking a body who has been donated to science, and they lay the body out in the field inside a fence, of course, but let it be subjected to different environmental conditions, and then they take a photograph of it on a regular basis to determine what it looks like in the decomposition process, what kind of insects eat on the body, and what kind of maturation level that the larvae of the insects develop. And from that, they also record the wind speed, the humidity, the temperature, all things like that that would aid in the decomposition speed. And then from that, they're able to provide a very valuable tool in addition to age, sex, and race, but they're also able to tell time since death. And that's very important a lot of times to you crime writers and science lovers alike, and that is when a body's found in the field, one of the first things that the cops want to know is how long has the body been there?
Absolutely, because that explodes or supports alibis and
exactly
statements and everything. Well, Mike, we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be back on the other side with Dr. Mike Tabor, and we'll talk more about what forensic dentistry is all about. Stay with us.
Homecoming song.
So welcome back, everybody, after the break here with Crime and Science Radio. Again, tonight's show is Take a Bite Out of Crime with special guest Michael Tabor. So now here's your host again for today's show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back, everyone. We're having a wonderful discussion here with forensic dentist Dr. Mike Tabor. And, Mike, we had mentioned earlier about DNA, and I know, and you mentioned about how tough teeth are and how they survive. But what about the DNA inside teeth? Is that a good place to find it in charred remains and old skeletal remains? And how do you actually go about extracting that stuff and using it?
Actually, it is, Doug. You know, DNA actually is the genetic coding that's unique to each of us. It's a very difficult aspect of science to understand. I thought Barry Scheck gave a wonderful attempt at trying to explain it to lay people in the O.J. Simpson trial. But how effective he was remains to be seen. But in a nutshell, we are now extracting DNA from the pulps of teeth. If any of you have been to a dentist and have had to have a root canal procedure done, you may remember that inside the center of this hard case shell of a tooth, you have enamel on the outside, and then inside is where a little blood vessel and nerve supply runs inside the center of the tooth. Well, if you have a blood supply in the human body, then you're going to have blood cells. And if you have blood cells, then you're going to have a DNA genetic code. And as a result of that, that's another thing that that odontology science and ABFO has really been recommending, and that is not only should we get a second opinion when we're looking at a bite mark, but if you think about it a minute, it's impossible to bite someone without leaving some saliva behind. Well, not only can you get DNA from blood, but you can get DNA from saliva. And so now we are recommending to all of our forensic facilities, if you have a patterned injury that looks oval, do a salivary swab from the center of it and preserve that. And then the forensic odontologist will have another resource to refer to and be able to use that, perhaps, at being able to help determine the source of which killer it actually is.
Well, you were involved in identifying the 9/11 World Trade Center victims. How did it come about that you became involved in that, since you're down in Tennessee and that's up in New York? How did that come about, and what did you do as part of that team?
During that year, Jan, was my year to be president of the American Board of Forensic Odontology, and some of our board of directors who had the same position for New York that I had for the state of Tennessee spoke to me, and we were talking about the enormity of this project. You know, death investigation was going on just like always before and after 9/11, and these facilities were quite taxed, and so quite a large percentage of expert forensic dentists volunteered their time by coming to New York and assisting the medical examiner with this task of trying to determine the identity of these bodies. Now, all of this was in an open population base. We mentioned that earlier. What's the difference in an open population base and a closed population? Closed population base would be if a baby has a bite mark on its arm and the baby's only been around a total of six people that could have had the mutually exclusive opportunity to bite the child, then we study the teeth patterns of all six people and render a comment or an opinion about that. Also, if we have a plane that goes down, we have an accurate flight manifest list. we attempt to procure the antemortem records from, and that's exactly what we did 9/11 with each airplane, and we got the dental records of those that we knew were on board, not counting, of course, the terrorists. We didn't know who that was, who they were. But then we start to accumulate this information, and once you get north of 25 or 30 bodies, you're going to have to use a computerized system or it's not going to work. It's just the logistics of being able to organize it is just about impossible. And so we did use a software package that we call WinID, which is a software program written and developed by one of our diplomates, Dr. Jim McGivney. And we used this software package and entering, remember going back to what we said, 5 to the 32nd power, we do a dental charting of all antemortem or before-death records. Those are the records that we got from the flight manifest list and from those family members whose husbands didn't return home from work that day, if they were a New York City police officer or a firefighter or a member of the New York Port Authority. And so there we began to build what we called our antemortem database. And then, you know, we had about 100 or 150 people that jumped from the buildings and chose to end their life rather than experiencing what must have been around the corner of that inferno that was about to take their life anyway. So we had some of those remains on the periphery of the building before, of course, the buildings collapsed. But we identified 1,000, approximately 1,000 out of 3,000 bodies. And a majority of them were done by forensic dentistry records. And a couple of things that are a little interesting people don't realize, you know, people from 83 different countries lost their lives that day. A lot of people think that, you know, it was just mostly Americans. And, of course, there were more Americans than there were any other nationality, but you know, we had rehearsed what's called mass disaster dental ID teams on how we're going to grid off an area and how we're going to set up identification logistics if, you know, if a 737 goes down and a couple hundred people are perished. But, you know, it was days, if you remember, before we didn't have any idea whether there was 3,000 or 30,000 people in the building. Mm-hmm. In fact, if the plane had hit just, you know, another 30 minutes later, it could have been even much more horrific than it already was. But, you know, it took us 11 or 12 months, right at a year, before we had the chance to go through each bit of evidence and enter it into the postmortem database. And then you let the computer sift through and look for similarities, and then we would pull the records based upon, again, the condition. Was this a gold filling on tooth number 4? And if so, what surfaces did it include? And that kind of thing would be written into the antemortem dental record, and then the computer goes out and searches from the postmortem team who, on the other side of the medical examiner's office, is working the project from that angle, and then let the computer do its work. And amazingly, we were able to do the identification. We were pretty pleased to get a third of them. A lot of people ask us, what happened? You know, how come you didn't identify the other 2,000? And to be honest with you, it's because they just don't exist. They're just vaporized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those
jumbo jets
had, each of them had two black boxes on each plane. That's 4 planes, so you got 8 black boxes. Those black boxes were supposed to be totally indestructible. You can drop them out of an airplane from 5 miles high, and they won't break when they land on a concrete driveway. And yet, you know how many black boxes we recovered? 0. Not a 1.
Wow.
That gives you an idea of the enormity of the impact of this. And so As you might imagine, there was a lot of what we call commingling of remains, and that's another problem that is quite objectionable to some people. But you know, we're trying our best to get it right. We're trying our best to make every ID stick and make it be accurate.
You know, I think especially in contemporary times, most of us have little contact with dead bodies. And I think a lot of people, especially bodies that may be in the condition that they're in for an odontologist to be called in to make an identification. Mm-hmm. But this scale of, you know, thousands is pretty unimaginable. So how did doing that work affect you personally?
That's a good question, Jan. I give about two or three talks a month now for, 13, 14 years, whatever. And it was 4 or 5 years before I could even talk about this part without getting just so choked up, because, to be honest with you, that's a really good point, and I'm glad you brought it up. We have no training or little training at dealing with the emotional impact of this. Now, you take this, you take 9/11. 9/11 was the game changer for everybody. You know, I've seen lots of things in my 30-something years in this, and most of them are pretty ugly, but I've never seen anything like this, and I've never experienced anything that stayed with me and won't go completely away. I've heard some of my buddies that talk about serving in Vietnam and post-traumatic stress disorder, and I really had a hard time getting my arms emotionally around, what is that? Is it really for real? Well, let me tell you something. After going, spending two different sessions at Ground Zero, I can tell you it is for real, folks. We're not used to dealing with that, Jan. We're not used to having to walk through a sea of people outside on the sidewalks at the morgue holding up pictures of their missing husband or their only son or their missing daughter. And when they see this badge around our neck as we're trying to get through the heavily secured building, we're not used to people coming up to us and pulling on our sleeve and say, "Doctor, please come here. Just give me 1 minute. You don't understand. This is my only son. I lost another son in Vietnam." I mean, I've heard everything. And we're not used to that. And so they told us that when we left, be prepared for your close family to comment that they notice a change in your spirit. And, of course, they were exactly right on the money. And so they did, I will say this, they did send us all through a psychological debriefing workshop, I guess you'd say, before we left. And you know, part of it, I think, is because of the enormity of the event and the attack. And then another part of it was the fact that we're just basically not used to dealing with, we're not the one that calls the family and gives them the bad news and has to wait on the phone while they catch their breath and while they cry and wail and weep and gnashing of teeth. And when you expose us to that, we are ill-equipped to deal with it. And then I think probably the last thing that makes this so enormous to all of us is the red, white, and blue that still flutters among all of us, and the fact that a foreign terrorist came to our country and did this to us. How dare they do that to us? But you know what? They sure did. And that, plus the fact that our inexperience at dealing with this end of it, I've had a dream in particular where I'm driving on a certain road here in Nashville, and I look up and I see a 727 with its tail on fire going nose down behind a hotel here in Nashville, and then I wake up when it hits the ground and explodes. I bet I had that dream 10 times in the first year, and and it's gradually dying away, but it's that is a prime example of post-traumatic stress disorder, whether you're a soldier in the rice paddies or IDing poor victims and firefighters that you open the body bag and the firefighter is still clutching his axe and his air cylinders reading double zeros because he sucked all the air out of it before he died. I mean, it'll really get to you. It really will.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us. That's pretty sobering information, and I hope everybody appreciates that.
Thank you.
You also worked with our mutual friend, the wonderful Dr. Cyril Wecht. I love that guy, and he's been on the show here, and we really had a great time with Cyril. He's just such a fond of knowledge. But you worked on some cases with him, one of which was James Earl Ray, speaking
right.
of national tragedies, and it had to do with charred remains and whatnot. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you worked with Cyril? And
I've actually done two cases with Cyril. One is going to be my third book out, and then the title of it is Grave Mistake. But the one I think you're referring to initially here is the one where we worked together on the forensic autopsy of James Earl Ray, and it's rather interesting. I'll give you a quick little summary on it. In a nutshell, James Earl Ray, of course, was serving a life sentence. He confessed at one time, and then he recanted, and then he reconfessed, and then he re-recanted. But anyway, jurors determined that he was guilty and died in prison. And a lot of people don't realize he died from hepatitis C from being stabbed by a fellow prisoner with a broken Coke bottle. And in Tennessee state law, if you die in a prison, then you're going to have a forensic autopsy by state law by the state medical examiner. And so I was called one day by our local medical examiner and said, we want you to come down here. James Earl Ray has died, and we want you to confirm his identity. And I thought, well, that sounds a little bit strange because everybody knows what James Earl Ray looks like. Wonder why they want to confirm that. But in reality, you know, it was only just a few years before, 1981 to be exact, that so many naysayers with the Kennedy, JFK assassination, so many things about conspiracy and about how did this happen or that happen, that finally they got a court order and exhumed the body of Lee Harvey Oswald in 1981. And there forensic dentistry played another role by confirming, because Oswald did have a he was in the military, so we got his army records, and forensic dentistry was able to identify, reconfirm the identity. Well, James Earl Ray's family had decided that as soon as the autopsy was completed, they were going to cremate James's body. Well, they had hired Dr. Weck, and that was the first time I'd met him, and he was here in Nashville to oversee and observe the autopsy on behalf of the Ray family. So that's how I got to meet Dr. Wecht to begin with. The rest of this portion of it seems to be a bit routine because I got to say it's the only time I've done a forensic dental examination to confirm the identity of someone that I knew who it was before I started. And yet, just to make sure, and I think our medical examiner was right on the money because, you know, different states have different laws regarding if you're going to cremate after death, there are different laws and rules regarding when do you have to do an autopsy and what do you have to save and what do you have to do before. Because remember, when you do cremation, your evidence is gone. And so they were going to cremate the next day, and as a result, we went ahead. And so Dr. Wecht and I worked together, and he oversaw, on behalf of the Ray family, not just the dental ID portion of it, but the forensic autopsy of the rest of his body at the same time. So that's another example of how forensic dentistry has lended itself to helping when they need to for confirmation of identification. So the second one I worked with him on is involves another tragic car accident where a van of six prisoners literally burned alive when their van caught fire. And then, unfortunately, a wayward medical examiner mis-ID'd the bodies just based upon the seat location. And then Dr. Wecht and I worked together because some of them were they lived all over the United States. And then Dr. Wecht and I worked together to sort out which body really went to which family, which, you know, it's really tough when you have to undo a puzzle backwards like that. And but anyway, it's been a wonderful experience to learn from him and get to know him, and I cherish every time I get to spend with him to learn more stuff from him. He's a really cool guy.
That's two great cases.
Two great cases, exactly. Let's talk a little bit about your books.
Okay.
Tell us about Walk of Death and about the case and whatnot involved in that before we run out of time here.
Walk of Death was what got me to my new most favorite thing in the world, and is to write down exactly what happened. I had a cold case murder that I worked on for over a decade before we finally solved it. And when we finally saw it, it started in about 1998, 1999, and we solved it Christmas of 2010. And I told my wife, I'm gonna write a book on this. You cannot make this stuff up. It is so bizarre. And it really involves a staged death where two killers pick up a hitchhiker and kill him just because they want a body to stuff behind the wheel to fraudulently cash in a life insurance policy. And believe it or not, they got a little sloppy and they got caught and they confessed. And then when they confessed, after they had even already collected their life insurance, the law enforcement says, well, wait a minute, who's buried in your grave? And they said, well, you know, we don't know. Well, at that point, the cops don't know whether to believe them or not, because if you'll kill somebody, you sure won't think twice about lying about something else. So anyway, we exhumed the body, and so for the next over 10 years, we spent trying to put a name with this face. And to be honest with you, it's the first time in Tennessee courts of law. I haven't found where it's ever happened in the United States, but I've not researched it thoroughly. But it's the first time we had a murder hearing in Nashville where we had two confessed killers, and no one in the courtroom knew who the victim was. Now think about that for a minute. That will get you a really upside-down jury. You know, usually you have somebody in the audience that comes up on the stand and cries because, you know, you rotten so-and-so, you killed Uncle Joe, and I'll never have anybody to eat Thanksgiving dinner with. My family's wrecked because of what you've done. Well, you know, when you kill somebody but you don't know who it was and you don't have a name, it's really hard to get emotional sympathy from certain kinds of people. And so as a result of that, it was a long, long time before I was afraid that these guys, they pled out to 15 years and they're getting out of prison next year, and we were afraid that they were going to get out of prison and we still didn't know who it was that they killed. But finally, using some DNA out of teeth that we were able to get from the body when we tried everything else, we finally were able to solve this crime. I better not tell the whole story. You guys might not want to read the whole storyline. It just goes to show you that some things are, the truth is stranger than fiction sometimes.
Now, so you said you're at work on your third now, or
I'm
more
actually
to come
just about,
from you,
just
right?
About finished with the second one. And then my
second,
third
okay.
one is going to be with Dr. Wecht on a grave mistake. My second one that will be coming out this next year is entitled Out of the Darkness, and it involves a bite mark case in a murder trial that I testified in Arkansas back in early 2000s regarding a bite mark and the controversy around the evidentiary value that bite mark evidence should be assigned in this particular homicide case.
Well, Mike, we can't wait to read them, and can't wait for them to hit the streets. And we've really, really enjoyed having you here. This is just fantastic material, and I'm sure our listeners are really going to be listening to this one over and over again because there's a lot of meat on this bone, no pun intended. and I want to thank you for being here. As
thank
our
you.
Listeners know also, you go to the websites, my website, the crimeandscienceradio.com website. We will have a lot of links to Dr. Tabor's website and his books and a lot of links for further study on the topics we have discussed today. And until next time, Jan and I want to thank you for being with us. And Mike, once again, great having you here.
Thank you so much, Jan. Thank you so much, Doug. I really appreciate your hospitality, and it's a pleasure being here today. I wish you guys all the best.
All right, thanks.
Have a good
thanks.
One.